picture this. You're on a road trip. You are absolutely starving,
Yeah.
and you pull over at one of those massive, glowing mega diners on the side of the highway.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly the kind you mean.
Right. So you slide into the booth, and the waiter hands you a menu. But it's not just a regular menu.
It's like a phone book.
Yes. It's this 20-page laminated encyclopedia of food. I mean, we're talking breakfast all day, full Italian section, steaks, sushi, tacos.
Which is always a red flag, by the way.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And like 85 different kinds of sandwiches. And suddenly your brain just flatlines.
Yeah, you just shut down.
Exactly. You go from being ravenous to just wanting to walk out the door, all because you were handed way too much information all at once.
It's so overwhelming.
So, welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. Today, we're actually taking that exact physiological reaction and mapping it onto digital design. We're unpacking a completely counterintuitive business reality.
Yeah, a really fascinating one.
We want to show you why giving your online customers that 20-page menu is actively destroying your sales. And more importantly, how to fix an interface that is just quietly overwhelming its visitors.
That diner scenario is such a perfect way to isolate the biological response to information overload, you know?
Right.
Because when businesses design their layouts, they sort of just assume they're dealing with perfectly rational actors, like people who have infinite time and infinite energy to weigh all these
No,
variables.
they don't.
No, they absolutely don't. Human cognition operates on strict.
Yes, the JAM study. Just as a quick refresher for anyone listening who hasn't thought about this in a while, researchers set up a tasting booth with 24 jams,
Lot of jam.
a lot of jam. And then later they set up a booth with just six jams. And the massive 24 jam display, it got tons of foot traffic, but it resulted in a total collapse in actual sales.
Right.
Like the small display outperformed the large one by a factor of 10. 10.
I want to move past the basic premise here. Mechanically, why does the human brain just completely short circuit when looking at the large display?
Well, it really comes down to how working memory functions in the prefrontal cortex. I mean, the human brain can only hold a handful of distinct items in its active working memory at any given second.
Okay.
So when a shopper stands in front of 24 jams or, scrolls through 40 software subscription tiers online, they're forced to perform continuous multivariable calculus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they have to weigh price, flavor profile, brand trust, and perceived utility for every single option against every other option, which I imagine exhausts the working memory almost instantly.
It drains cognitive glucose super fast.
Next.
And the moment that cognitive threshold is breached, this secondary psychological mechanism kicks in the fear of regret.
The fear of regret.
Yeah. Every time you evaluate two similar options, choosing one inherently means discarding the other. So when all options look relatively valid, the brain calculates a massive opportunity cost.
Oh, I see.
Picking the strawberry Huey Gem feels like you're actively losing out on the blackberry ginger.
So it's basically a subconscious risk assessment going on.
Exactly. The brain intensely dislikes the potential for buyer's remorse. So when the perceived risk of making a suboptimal choice outweighs the anticipated reward of the product, the neurological path of least resistance is just to defer the decision entirely.
You just walk away.
You walk away. Buying nothing actually becomes the safest possible choice to avoid psychological discomfort.
Okay, I have to challenge this logic on behalf of the consumer, though.
Bring it on.
Because if I'm shopping for something high stakes, like, say, a new laptop or specialized camping gear, I actively seek out the mega menus.
Right, you want all the details.
I do. I want to see all 50 configurations to make sure I don't miss a crucial feature.
So, doesn't the paradox of choice kind of ignore the fact that buyers inherently want to feel empowered by a full data set? Isn't this just FOMO applied to groceries?
It's a fair question, but seeking out the data set and actually being able to process it are two very different things.
Okay, fair.
What you're describing is a.
Yeah, you become so terrified of missing out on the optimal configuration that you end up paralyzed. You abandon the cart to, quote, do more research later.
Wow, yes. I have a graveyard of open browser tabs that prove that exact point.
We all do.
Which brings us directly to the digital equivalent of that 24-jam display. Because if working memory crashes when faced with unstructured volume, it completely explains why the default layout for almost every online store is a total conversion disaster.
Oh, the dreaded product grid.
Classic product grid. You click a link, you land on a site, and you're immediately staring at a symmetrical 4x5 grid of 20 identical looking thumbnails.
It's awful. The flat product grid is arguably the most common structural failure in digital commerce today. It completely abdicates the responsibility of navigation.
It's like dumping a 1,000-piece puzzle onto a table in front of a total stranger, hiding the picture on the box, and just telling them they have 30 seconds to figure out what they're building.
That's a great analogy.
There are no start here signals. There's no visual hierarchy, just nothing to grab onto.
Right. And from a cognitive load perspective, a flat grid forces a visitor who, keep in mind, probably just arrived on your domain mere seconds ago, to construct their own heuristic framework totally from scratch.
And they don't know anything about your brand yet.
Exactly. They have zero familiarity with your naming conventions. They don't intrinsically know the difference between your pro version, your elite version, and your max version.
Right. They all sound like the same thing.
Right. So by presenting a flat grid, the designer basically puts the entire metabolic weight of decoding the inventory onto the user.
And as we just established, the user will just refuse to burn that metabolic energy and they'll bounce.
And they're gone.
But you know, based on the materials for this deep dive, it's not just the visual flatness that makes the grid fail. There's a deeper structural flaw here. The product grid treats every single person looking at it as the exact same user, completely ignoring who they actually are.
Yeah, this touches on user intent mapping. Because when we look at traffic, we're dealing with fundamentally divergent psychographics.
Let's ground this in a specific example. Imagine a skincare brand with a huge cult following.
Perfect context. So take a first-time visitor who just clicked an ad for this skincare brand. They've never used, say, a chemical exfoliant before.
Right.
They're highly skeptical, and they're probably overwhelmed by all the scientific terminology. Showing them a grid of 40 different toners, serums, and acids is catastrophic.
It's way too much.
They need strict guardrails. They need a curated entry point that basically says, if you are new to this routine, start with this exact three-step kit.
So they need you to confidently remove options from their view.
They require heavy curation, yes. But now, contrast that with a returning power user who has been buying that brand for 3 years.
Oh, but totally different mindset.
Totally different. If that power user logs on and is forced through this slow, hand-holding, beginner-focused funnel that hides all the niche experimental products, they're going to feel patronized. They'll be frustrated.
They just want to browse.
They want the raw database. They want to filter by specific active ingredients across the entire catalog.
So the friction here is that the beginner gets paralyzed by the full catalog, but the loyal fanatic gets bottlenecked by the beginner kit.
Exactly.
So when a site just throws a static product grid at both of them, it fails everyone.
Yeah.
I love how the source material puts this. It's a segmentation problem masquerading as a display problem.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
You're using the exact same visual vocabulary to speak to two entirely different personas, which means you effectively communicate with neither of them.
The architecture has to dynamically route these distinct intents.
But practically speaking, how does a team actually execute that if they only have one primary landing page? I mean, you can't build a custom site for every individual visitor without creating massive technical debt.
No, you definitely can't.
So how on earth do you cater to the beginner who needs training wheels? Any the power user who wants to sprint without just cluttering up the interface all over again?
It requires engineering intentional divergent pathways at the very top of the visual hierarchy.
Okay, what does that look like?
Well, you don't expose the grid immediately. The hero section of the page, the very first thing they see, should cater almost exclusively to the highest probability visitor, which is usually the uninitiated prospect.
The beginner.
Right. You present a singular friction-free choice, a flagship product, or maybe a diagnostic quiz. But, and this is the critical architectural detail, you build a highly visible, persistent secondary path specifically for the veteran.
Like a subtle button somewhere.
Yeah, a subtle but clear utility navigation that says shop all or advanced filter.
Ah, so you lead with your strongest assumption, but you leave a side door unlocked for the veteran so they can bypass the tour guide.
Exactly. It satisfies both cognitive requirements without mixing the streams.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Now let's look at how companies traditionally try to solve this lack of hierarchy, because they almost always do it in a way that actively destroys the very tools they're trying to use.
Oh, this is the worst.
Right. When teams realize their grid is too flat, they panic, and they just start slapping bestseller badges and star ratings on everything.
The misuse of visual signaling, it is an absolute epidemic in user interface design.
It really is. to use a physical metaphor here, if you put a high-visibility neon safety vest on every single employee in a crowded warehouse, nobody stands out anymore.
Right, everyone's glowing.
The vest completely ceases to be a safety mechanism. It just becomes background noise. And the exact same thing happens when a site slaps a bestseller or, you know, fan favorite badge on four different products in the exact same view.
The signal-to-noise ratio completely collapses. A digital badge does not exist, so a company can brag about its inventory volume. Psychologically, it functions as a heuristic, a mental shortcut.
Okay.
Its sole purpose is to lower the user's anxiety by providing a trusted default.
It tells the brain, hey, thousands of other people survived making this choice, so it's perfectly safe for you to make it too.
Exactly. And because of that, it relies entirely on the principle of extreme scarcity. A page can only sustain one, maybe two, clear anchor signals before the brain stops registering them as shortcuts and starts registering them as just marketing clutter.
Right, it just looks like spam at that point.
Exactly. The moment you introduce a third badge into the same visual field, you force the user to start comparing the best sellers against each other, instantly plunging them right back into the cognitive gridlock of the paradox of choice.
The exact same logic applies to social proof, too, like review aggregates.
Oh, absolutely. Proximity and placement dictate the effectiveness of social proof, not just the raw numbers.
So having a huge banner at the very bottom of the page boasting about 10,000 five-star reviews doesn't actually move the needle if it's completely disconnected from the moment of decision.
It's practically useless down there. If the social proof is buried below the fold, separated from the product thumbnail and the add to cart button, the brain does not connect the validation to the action.
It has to be immediate.
Right. The review count needs to act as a localized risk mitigation tool. If you feature one primary anchor product and you position a clean, 4.9 stars from 5,000 users metric immediately adjacent to the price, you create a localized validation loop.
You're giving the working memory permission to just stop evaluating alternatives and trust the crowd.
Precisely.
Well, let's talk about that price placement, because the source material dives into something fascinating here. It's not just about highlighting a product with a badge. The literal sequential order in which you present your options fundamentally manipulates how a buyer perceives value.
Price anchoring.
Yes, price anchoring. And psychological sequencing.
This is where behavioral economics completely overrides traditional inventory management. The anchoring heuristic, which was pioneered by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, demonstrates that the human brain relies way too heavily on the first piece of information it receives when making subsequent judgments.
Let's map that onto a pricing table. Say a software company has three subscription tiers, $50, $100, and $200.
Okay, so if the layout presents the $200 tier first, reading left to right, that high number becomes the psychological anchor.
It sets the bar.
Right. The brain calibrates its expectation of cost against that $200 baseline. So when the user's eye moves to the middle tier at $100, it no longer registers as a $100 expense. It registers as a 50% discount relative to the anchor.
Wow, so it feels like a really safe economical compromise.
Exactly. The high price shields the middle price. But if you reverse that sequence,
the psychology instantly turns hostile, doesn't it?
Totally hostile.
Yeah.
If you present the $50 tier first, that becomes the baseline. Now, the $100 middle tier feels like a 100% markup. You have accidentally framed your core product as an expensive upsell and your premium product as an outrageous luxury.
So wait, this completely recontextualizes how filtering tools work on retail sites.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. When a budget-conscious shopper immediately hits the sort by price, low to high drop-down, they're basically weaponizing the site's own UX against the store's average order value.
Oh, absolutely.
Because by forcing the cheapest possible items to load first, the user sets an artificially low anchor in their own mind, which guarantees that the mid-tier and premium inventory will feel like a massive ripoff by comparison.
The user's filtering action inadvertently sabotages the brand's perceived value. This is exactly why organizing a layout based on inventory logic, like sorting by SKU, alphabetical order, or sheer price ascending, is a massive unforced error.
It's just bad business.
It really is. Layouts must be dictated by psychological sequencing, intentionally setting high anchors to make the target purchase feel like a victory for the consumer.
Which brings us to a really uncomfortable philosophical tension that the source material highlights. We're talking about intentionally hiding the catalog from new users.
Yeah.
We're talking about manipulating the sequence of prices to reframe their perception of value. Is there not a legitimate debate here about paternalism?
The paternalism debate is actually central to modern UX design.
Because if a team deliberately removes options from the main view, they're making a massive, borderline arrogant assumption that they know what the customer wants better than the customer does. I mean, isn't it inherently manipulative to steer a visitor away from a niche product they might have organically discovered and loved just to force them down a streamlined conversion funnel?
It's a very valid ethical friction point. However, looking at the data, the counterargument is deeply rooted in the reality of human behavior versus theoretical freedom.
Walk us through the counterargument.
Well, first, you aren't permanently deleting the niche inventory. You're just pacing its introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the physical floor plan of an Apple store or maybe a high-end fashion boutique.
Well,
they don't pile every single charging cable, adapter, and niche accessory in a chaotic heap at the front entrance in the name of, you know, total consumer choice.
No, definitely not. The front tables are immaculate. It's just the flagship phones and laptops spaced really far apart on clean wooden tables.
Exactly. They curate the sensory entry into their ecosystem. The adapters and cables are tucked away on a wall in the back. A digital layout is no different. The question isn't whether you're manipulating the user's attention. The moment you put a pixel on a screen, you're directing attention.
Right.
The question is whether you are directing it intentionally toward clarity or defaulting to a chaotic grid that triggers a stress response. Throwing 50 products against the wall is still a curatorial choice. It's just an incredibly negligent one.
Wow, so robust curation is actually a form of digital hospitality. You're basically absorbing the cognitive load so the user doesn't have to.
Yes, beautifully put.
But how does a team actually know they are making the right curatorial choices before they launch? Because if you hide the wrong things, your sales still tank.
That is where the methodology shifts from guessing to simulation. The brief details the emergence of some incredible advanced tooling, specifically platforms like Dayclerk, which do audience simulation. It completely changes how we test these hierarchies.
How does that actually work mechanically? I mean, I know A/B testing uses live traffic, but audience simulation sounds entirely different.
It's entirely different. Instead of launching a flawed page and waiting for live human traffic to bounce, which, by the way, costs real money and burns real leads looks, Dayclerk utilizes synthetic user agents.
Synthetic user agent.
Yeah. These are effectively large language models programmed with specific, highly detailed psychographic profiles and intent states.
So you're unleashing AI personas onto your staging site to see how they react.
At a mechanical level, yes. These synthetic agents parse the document object model, or DOM, of the staging page. They analyze the visual hierarchy, the text density, and the number of actionable choices presented in the viewport. And the system uses heuristic evaluation algorithms to calculate a cognitive friction score at every single scroll depth.
That is wild. It mathematically predicts where the brain will short circuit.
It maps the probability of drop-off path. So it can flag, before a single line of code goes live, that a specific segment of new users will abandon the session at section 3 because they are presented with 12 competing calls to action simultaneously.
Right. Way too much noise.
Exactly. This allows product teams to proactively strip away the clutter, refine the price anchors, and ensure the visual signaling is airtight before real humans ever even see the interface. It shifts optimization from a reactive salvage operation to a proactive design standard.
It completely flips the paradigm. It proves that the goal of digital design is not to offer infinite flexibility, but to engineer ultimate clarity.
The human brain just does not want more data. It wants a clear path forward.
So synthesizing everything we have unpacked today, the working memory limits, the nightmare of the flat grid, the collapse of overused badges, and the psychology of price anchoring, what is the ultimate operational takeaway for the listener?
The takeaway is a really simple diagnostic test you can run right now. Look at your own digital layout or a platform you manage and ask one defining question. What is the single clearest path given to a visitor who has absolutely no prior knowledge of this brand?
Not the most comprehensive path, not the path with the most options.
No, the absolute clearest, lowest friction path. If you cannot trace that journey with your finger in 3 seconds, the architecture is failing. And the solution is never to add more tooltips, more banners, or more explanatory text.
Right.
The solution is ruthless editorial discipline. You have to be willing to sacrifice the visibility of good options so that the great option can dominate the screen.
Ruthless editorial discipline, taking a machete to the clutter so the actual signal can get through.
Exactly. And this framework actually applies far beyond just digital commerce. The underlying psychology here raises a vital question about how we construct our own daily environments.
Oh, I have a feeling this is going to hurt.
Well, think about your physical workspace right now, or your digital desktop. If the paradox of choice and unstructured grids induce a biological stress response that forces buyers to flee a website, consider the toll of your own uncurated environment.
Oh, man. The 50 open browser tabs. The desktop completely covered in unsorted files.
The endless notifications, the lack of hierarchy in your daily tooling. How much is the sheer, uncurated volume of your own digital life exhausting your working memory before you even begin your tasks?
Wow.
How often is that lack of editorial discipline causing your brain to quietly bounce from your most critical deep work?
That is a staggering parallel. We're all basically just standing in the diner, staring at a 20-page menu of our own tasks,
yeah,
wondering why we're too tired to actually order anything.
The biology is identical. Whether it's a product page or a morning routine, if you curate your choices, you protect your clarity.
Curate your choices, protect your clarity. That is the exact note we need to end on. Look at your layouts and look at your browser tabs and start closing them down. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you next time.